Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Michael Morris in Cape Town. Michael, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you indeed, Nick. How are you doing?
I am doing pretty good, pretty good. It is a clear winter day here in Joburg. And of course, we're also joined by Mr. Marius Ruart, who is temporarily in London. Marius, how are you?
All right, and you guys?
Did you survive the heat wave?
Yeah, I did. It was nearly 40 degrees here on Tuesday, but then I went up to the grim north of the UK, where the next day was about 18 degrees. So it was also pretty grim. So I went to go watch South Africa lose at Old Trafford on Friday afternoon. So that wasn't great.
Well, that's not fantastic, but you still got to watch some cricket, so yeah. I suppose it's not too bad. All right, so let me first give us a word from our sponsor. We have the same sponsor this week as we did last week, and that is Bitvice. And here's a couple of words from them. Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African-first, Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. That's why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your Bitcoin wallet where you hold the keys. They don't hold your keys. They don't hold your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. We thank them very much for sponsoring us. So on to our first story, and this is this is from a really fascinating character, I think, in the analysis landscape of South Africa. And this is, of course, Gigi Elcock. So he recently gave an interview to, I think it was BizNews, talking a little bit about how he sees the economy is going at the moment. So he made a number of claims, but let's start with one he did in 2019. So quite controversially, and we can maybe talk about this once we get into it. In 2019, he claimed that StatsSA was not truly capturing, with its unemployment figures, the number of people who were actually doing some kind of work in South Africa. He believes that our informal economy is actually underrepresented in the official stats, and as a result, the real unemployment rate was not in the high 30s or 40s, but actually more like 12%. So that was his take in 2019. He says he still stands by that approximation. He says it's more sort of an eyeball than an exact figure, but he's still willing to stand by it. He also has talked a lot about how he thinks that the township economy or the Kasi economy has really been booming in recent months. He thinks that due to, firstly, the lockdowns, which forced everyone to kind of stay in their own locales and really restricted travel, as well as the extremely high cost of petrol at the moment is pushing people in South Africa's townships, or what used to be South Africa's townships. He also talks a little bit about how that's not quite the same thing as it used to be, to stay around the places that they live and shop there rather than traveling out to the suburbs, so to speak, to do their shopping. So he's called these people Kasipolitans, people who are very rooted in the township for everything, from entertainment to shopping, staying at home. And he says that there's some evidence of this, which is that if you go to shopping centers, the queues since COVID are insane in townships. People are staying there for 40 minutes to 2 hours. He says that there's an increasingly informal economy within the townships. It's also increasingly difficult to define what a township is. You've got the historical townships, like, for example, Soweto. There were 29 suburbs in Soweto. Now they're 35, and the suburbs look prettier. They're not really a township in the old sense. They're sort of townhouses and clusters. And then, of course, you still have what used to be called townships kind of popping up. He also goes on to talk about how most South Africans do, in fact, live in formal housing, sort of 70% or so. That there's an enormous amount of money being paid by, for example, foreign shop owners in rent to South Africans across the country. And this is a revenue stream that's not actually being captured. On the issue of declining purchases, which is one thing that people flagged as a sign that people are struggling economically, he says that this is actually due to the fact that the size of households is falling, and as a result, people aren't buying in bulk like they used to. So he says that, you know, once upon a time, you might have 7 people in a household, and you'd then go and buy a bag of Millimeal that was like 12 kilograms. But now, if your household is only 3 people, well, maybe you're going to buy the 3-kilogram one because you don't need that much. So he says basically that despite government's plans and dreams of creating, you know, these top down black industrialists who are going to lift up the economy, that ordinary South Africans are getting along with it for themselves and creating economic opportunity outside of, shall we say, the normal rules and regulations, and that government is woefully sort of out of step with how people are actually behaving. So, Michael, let me start with you. Firstly, do we agree with all of his claims? Secondly, what do you make of this idea that, you know, people are just sort of getting on with it in making economic opportunity?
Mm. On the first point, we prior to the show we were talking about Gigi Alcock's estimation of the unemployment rate, and his figure is pretty low, and we kind of felt that maybe he's a bit out of whack there. But he certainly is in touch very much with the part of the economy that is probably not as well understood as it should be. It often strikes me, you know, that we're a country with large pockets of poverty, but we're not really a country that has a starvation crisis. For instance, you know, I think there might be people who are really living on the edge. It wouldn't take much to push them over into a sort of crisis mode of living, of just literally not having enough to eat. But generally speaking, even where people are poor, they are resourceful. And to me, one of the big indicators of that is the rising and continuing urbanization from what are indeed very poor rural areas to the cities and towns. I think it takes a lot to move, even for middle-class people, it takes a lot. It can be expensive. It's a step into the unknown for many people. But there is, you know, I think it is a very good indicator of a sense among people and a certainty, actually, because people make these decisions not lightly, but, you know, they consider them carefully because so much rides on it. There's definitely a sense that life is better in the urban areas. And I think Alcock's research is kind of pointing to many of the dynamics as to why this is so. I've often been struck by it's a kind of mathematical equation, I suppose, almost, devised by urban economists here in Cape Town, as far as I can recall. And it's the 40 by 40 by 40 rule. It's people who live in 40 square meter homes, who live about 40 kilometers away from where they work and spend about 40% of their income getting to work. Now that it kind of defines sort of the kind of classic legacy of apartheid spatial planning. Bad stuff. The poorest people live plonked furthest from the workplaces. They spend a huge sum of money that they earn on just getting to work. And it's not a very encouraging proposition. And yet, we now have Kasi economics that has responded to this. The fact that people are there, they do have income. You know, the whole spaza shop network is quite an interesting thing. The food is packaged differently. You get much more convenient, smaller packages of food as you need them, and all these things that Gigi Alcock is kind of exploring, I think, explain why urbanization is happening, why we're not keeling over on the streets of starvation, and how the society sustains itself. It's all really fascinating.
I think there's an interesting thing here. So it's been talked about sometimes that townships should be a place that should be made into special economic zones. So this is following on a model that places like China have done, where you basically suspend a lot of the normal rules, regulations, and taxes in a specific geographic area in order to rush economic growth there. And in some senses, you know, South Africa's townships do already have that going for them, not by design, but due to the fact that the sort of policing and municipal governance, which is supposed to, for example, you know, do building inspections to see whether you're complying with those, or, you know, check up to make sure that you're not hiring illegals or paying under minimum wage. A lot of that doesn't happen in South Africa's sort of township areas. And as a result, there is a space for businesses to operate there that doesn't exist in the sort of formal economy, just because there's no one enforcing the draconian rules that would strangle business normally. Marius, I look, you know, I'm really not nearly as qualified as Gigi Alcock to comment on any of these things or to question his stats here. I must say they don't feel right to me, some of them. I think he may be over-exaggerating the things that are going on in Carcinomics. I know, for example, in Zimbabwe, there's a huge number of very entrepreneurial people, and this is recorded in stats of like the number of people who own their own business. But this is not actually a sign of good economic conditions. This is a sign of people having to desperately find whatever they can to sort of escape the crushing weight of poverty. But what I do really like about what he's saying here is he's really kind of questioning, you know, what are we actually getting from the research that StatsSA does, and is it showing us everything about the country? What are your thoughts, Maurice?
I think overall, StatsSA is probably still a fairly good organization. I think it's probably still easily the best statistical agency in South Africa. I mean, in Africa. But as with anything, it needs money to keep its high standards. And like with just about every entity linked to the government in this country, it's the amount of money available to it has been shrinking. So I think you'd certainly have to look at kind of Gigi Alcock's stats to get a more holistic view of the economy. Also, what was I was looking at some data earlier. Looking at banking transactions between April and June, if you compare to the same period, or if you compare to the first 3 months of the year, to January to March, there was an increase of nearly 4% in banking transactions overall in South Africa. And that's quite a good indicator of how economic activities are working and so on. And that's obviously just purely bank transactions. So that's not looking at cash transactions and so on. And I'm sure, especially in what you'd call is the old townships, there's lots of cash transactions and what have you. Just as an aside, I actually have a friend who works in kind of with people in informal economy, goes into townships and provides them with ATM payment points where you can pay with your card and whatever, because there's obviously these guys will, Shabin or Tavern over weekend will probably get quite a high amount of turnover and other kinds of businesses as well. Right. So a lot of guys actually want to move towards a more formal way of interacting.
Exactly, because you know, cash is great for avoiding tax and for being, you know, able to get it from people who are very poor. But the downside is then people come into your tavern with AK-47s and shake you down for all of your money, and then you've lost everything. So that's not great.
And overall, I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but I know that South Africa is fairly well banked, actually. We've got much higher proportion of people who do have bank accounts and that than most other African countries and so on. And, I mean, if we look at some of the industries in South Africa, the kind of informal ones, I mean, the taxi industry is it's huge. I mean, it's billions of rands. And I think probably a lot of people watching and myself aren't the biggest fans of taxis, but to be honest, they are heroes of the free markets, actually, and they fulfilled a role during apartheid where people were dumped, as Michael was saying, 40 Ks away from work opportunities and given. I mean, these were people who couldn't afford the private vehicles at the time. You know, there was no decent public transport. So the gap was filled with the taxis. And obviously, I mean, there's a lot to criticize the taxi industry for. I mean, they certainly aren't angels, but they've also fulfilled a role. And I understand when they do get angry about, the municipalities want to come in and provide buses. I'm not saying that we should rely on taxis, but I do understand where there can be these kinds of issues. But also, I mean, that is also a kind of creative distraction where, you know, innovation comes in and destroys old ways of doing things.
Yeah, I think what Michael's point there is that he said earlier, there's a really great thing to remember here, which is that, you know, if you look at South African history, you can make a pretty strong case that since at least 1910 and probably since before, in fact, maybe forever, it's been badly governed in different ways, but it's been badly governed. And yet it continues to sort of just go on. And I think there is something to be said about the fact that South Africans are able to make a plan, as the saying goes, despite things. And in a sense, because we've been misgoverned for so long, we're actually quite good at making a plan.
There was, I forget his first name, but the Kivit, he was a famous South African historian. And he said, South Africa, South Africa advances by political, by economic windfalls, and regresses by political disasters. And I think that's probably still the case in this country.
Yeah.
And I think he said this in the 1940s or 1950s, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And I think it's still true today.
Indeed. Who says we're all doom and gloom on this show?
Exactly.
Something interesting to think about. All right, so we've done the good stuff. Let's get to the gloom and doom. Over the weekend, we had an ANC conference in KZN, and I think we saw what, to my mind, was the first real big crack in Ramaphosa's control of the ANC. He's looked pretty firm in his dominance of the ANC over the last while, but ever since the Palapala scandal and various other things, he's really been kind of struggling, I think, to keep his head above water in the same way that he was previously. And the Ramaphosa-aligned faction over the weekend was defeated by the what we might call the pro-Zuma faction, or at least the anti-Ramaphosa faction in the KZN elective conference, where in what was quite a shock, it seems, to the people writing about this, it was a clean sweep of all the anti-Ramaphosa candidates being elected. Even worse for Ramaphosa, he tried to speak, and he was the newly elected chairman had to basically prevent the crowd from booing him, saying, "Don't boo Mr. Ramaphosa, because otherwise that's all the media is going to report on." And some people tried at the start, but it's only with the support of the local leadership that he was actually able to do his speech without being sort of shouted down, which is not a sign that you are in a good place politically, even though this is, shall we say, enemy territory, at least for him. Other things that this conference resolved, so apart from electing anti-Ramaphosa candidates, they resolved that they would send delegates to the ANC's National Policy Conference, which is going to be held soon, with a proposal that the step-aside rule, which was used to get rid of, for example, Ace Magashule, should be scrapped. According to the KZN conference, the conference notes the implementation of the step-aside rule has had serious repercussions to the unity of the ANC at all levels. The 2022 ANC KwaZulu-Natal Policy Conference discussion documents acknowledge the step-aside rule has serious contestation, believing the inconsistent application of the rule deviates from its original intentions and results in unintended consequences of rejection. That's the direct quote. It's also interesting to see that the current premier, Sihle Sikilala, was chucked out of his chairmanship position in the ANC and KZN, which surely must be a blow. And I suspect then that means he might soon be removed from his position as the premier of KZN. But who knows? Maurice, what do you make of all this? Oh, sorry. One thing I forgot to mention is, of course, the nickname for the anti-Ramaphosa faction is the Taliban, which is, I don't know the origins of the name, but that's quite the name.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably not such a surprise. We've in KwaZulu-Natal, the ANC was always historically fairly weak until about 2004, around about there. Then ANC support really started to grow. Then we saw it really jump with Zuma becoming president of the party. But we saw just between 2014 and 2019, the ANC lost 10 percentage points in KwaZulu-Natal in those two elections, and they did pretty badly in losses local government elections. Pretty much in the north of the province, they were voted out. I mean, they lost to Ungani in the Midlands to the DA.
They only barely hold on to Itagwini.
Exactly. I mean, they only got 42% in Itagwini when two elections before they'd got nearly two-thirds of the vote. So the ANC is really under big pressure in KwaZulu-Natal. It's still the single biggest party in the province, but I think it's certainly on its way out there. And I think this is kind of, you don't go too far, but you do get the feeling that the party is falling apart. There's the kicks of a dying horse. I mean, I think we'll see probably a lot of people looking at what's happened in the ANC and turning against. We've seen, you know, you often get told in South Africa that, you know, that ANC voters will never change and they'll keep voting for the ANC. They're like kind of these automatons. But we've seen that's not the case. People, you know, no matter what their race, they can decide to vote together. I mean, the people will vote for their own interests. And while the ANC is still going to be, I think, part of South Africa's politics for a very long time, and I mean, a lot can still happen in South Africa. I'm not sure it's very likely, but I'm not saying the ANC can decide to do ZANU-PF on us and kind of hold on to power after it's been voted out. But I think the ANC, and I think this is a symptom of what's happening to the ANC. It's, as I said, it's the kind of the kicks of a dying horse. And we've seen the kind of things that the policy documents coming at the ANC recently. There's no new thinking. There's nothing innovative. You know, all the new thinking is coming from other parts of our politics. And even if you look at young people who are coming into politics now, very few dynamic young people are in the ANC. Off the top of my head, I can think maybe one person who's under 40 that is fairly impressive. I don't necessarily agree with his politics, but you can string a sentence together. Is Wanda Lamola. Everybody else who seems to be dynamic and young and getting into politics is either in the EA or Action SA or EFF. You know, I mean, you can disagree with the EFF, obviously, but I mean, those parties, if you're a young person getting into politics, I don't think many people are looking at the ANC anymore.
So one of the big questions now is, you know, does this mean that Ramaphosa is going to lose at the ANC's elective conference at the end of the year? And this is, I think, the big one that a lot of people want to know. We've been, I think, pretty down on that idea so far, because I think most of the provinces are still backing Ramaphosa. But, you know, this is the ANC's biggest province. So he's probably still going to win, but I don't know. Michael, what do you make of the ANC's political landscape? Obviously, it's a little bit difficult to tell. You know, with all the delegates and the machinations and the side switching that goes on behind the scenes, it's very difficult to tell what's going to happen in an ANC elective conference. I mean, we saw that in recently when Ramaphosa was elected president of the ANC. But I don't know. What do you make of this?
It is difficult to judge, I think. You know, there's a temptation, as Mario says, to see this as, you know, yet another sign of the continuing decline of this old nag on its last legs. One of the things that intrigues me, and I mean, that would all actually be good news, I think, that we'd rather have the crisis come on quicker and sooner so that we can confront what needs to be confronted and begin to focus on what follows. But I mean, you talk about, you know, what research has shown and perhaps our own surveys and our own sense of how things are playing out is the popularity of Ramaphosa himself as opposed to the party. I mean, it's very striking in our own research, isn't it, that he is their key asset. And how strange then that, you know, you have these squabbles that are very public and very damaging, presumably, to their key asset. It's quite an odd thing. What do you make of that, Maurice? You're much more attuned to the political side of
it. Well, I think I don't think Ramaphosa is as strong as he was a couple of months ago. But I think, I mean, all the kind of polling research shows that the ANC is far less popular than Ramaphosa himself. I think from different things I've read, he still has an approval rating, or the last one I heard might be a bit different now, was around about 60%, where
I would not be surprised if it's fallen significantly since then because of how bad his news cycles
are. And load shedding and obviously the pala-pala stuff and so on. But I think still the ANC knows he's probably still their best electoral asset. I mean, think of somebody who could come and, you know, as kind of Ramaphosa's, I don't know if you could call it gravitas anymore, but he's, you know, he's not as openly dodgy as many other people in the ANC. I think if he'd lost in the 2017 ANC policy conference or ANC elective conference, I think the ANC would have been very close to having lost their national majority in 2019. And I think they would, I mean, I think it would be a done deal that they would have lost in 2024. So I think Ramaphosa is the one kind of thing that's keeping the ANC above 50%. But even now, and we can see the kind of how the chattering classes, who generally always fairly big supporters of Ramaphosa, not necessarily the ANC. I mean, people like Peter Bruce come to mind, you know, Adrian Basson is maybe another example. They're kind of turning against Ramaphosa himself. And I think, and just from, I mean, obviously Twitter's not real life, but there also seems to be kind of a groundswell against both Ramaphosa and the ANC. So we'll have to see what happens.
Indeed. Once again, more evidence that we are entering a political shakeup. And yeah, I think one of our colleagues may have said, and I apologize when I was quoting them, that at this point, Ramaphosa has been critically wounded, so that even if he remains as a president of the ANC, he's going to be in a very weak position going forward. All right, let's move on to our last story.
I just want to say, a wild animal that's wounded is always most dangerous. So.
Indeed. And we're going to have more discussions, I think, going forward about the Electoral Amendment Act, which is something that we're a little bit concerned about going forward. And that's, of course, connected to this. Anyway, so our last story for today, the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa has been plagued. It's South Africa's biggest union still, I think. It claims to have a third of a million members. It's got lots of workers in, for example, the automobile industry. It has been struck by major internal squabbles, though, over its leadership positions. Mm. And recently, a number of officials, including the second deputy president, took the union to court, saying that their suspension from the organization had been unconstitutional according to the constitution of NUMSA. And the judge agreed with them, saying that set aside their suspension, saying that the union had not complied with its own constitution when suspending officials, and that its five-day elective conference could not continue until it did so. But the judge had quite a lot of harsh words for the union going forward. The judge went on to say that the leadership tussle within worker organizations was becoming cancerous. It diverts what's supposed to be a worker association to personal fiefdoms, and that the Central Committee of NUMSA must do a serious introspection. The leadership tussle does not often serve the best interests of the ordinary worker, who looks upon a worker association as a body that shall vindicate his or her rights without fear, favor, or compromise. The members of NUMSA deserve better and proper protection. Michael, you had some thoughts on this and kind of how it connects to the other stories we've talked about today.
You know, unions, it's a kind of topic on which people have pretty strong opinions, and they often reject unions as a kind of a wasteful and damaging presence in the economy or in society. And I can see the reason for this kind of antipathy or hostility, but one has a sense that unions are in fact very much a part of the equation of a free society, that you need to at least have the scope for people who work together and earn their income likely from the same source to band together and to argue the case for their interests. And what we see here is inimical to that. I think it's actually a shame that especially in this society where we need every civil society organization to be functioning well, to be representing the interests of their particular sector. It's actually a shame that we are sitting with a situation where unionism itself appears to be the end objective. We have these fairly well-paid people in a society where there is, in fact, so much unemployment, representing a kind of dwindling workforce. It's really a negative factor in our society, I think, and very striking that the judge has essentially made this point. So pointed out.
Morris, what do you make of this?
Yeah, I think it's there's lots of weird stuff happening at NUMSA. As I was saying to you guys before the show, they've apparently been bankrolled by a guy called Roy, I think it's Sangam, who's also funding New Frame and just pulled the money at the end or recently for New Frame. So didn't necessarily agree with New Frame's positions, but I thought it was a quality publication. Obviously feel sorry for the 30 people or so that worked there. Yeah. Also, this guy apparently funded the Social Revolutionary Workers Party, which was Ivan Jim's political party he started. So, but I think, I'm not opposed to unions in principle, but I'm not too sure that unions in South Africa are actually adding too much, adding to or trying to give us any solutions, really. They seem to be...
They're still infected with this sort of Soviet anti-capitalist view of, like, internal revolution and destruction of the capitalist class.
And they talk about the capitalist running dogs and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Ace
trade out the 60s, which, I mean, is obviously not... That's not what we need it's 2022 now, you know. We need to think of different ways of doing things.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in some ways, the 60s are kind of back in fashion, unfortunately. But anyway, let's not dwell on that. And before I go, I forgot to mention this at the beginning. Apparently, heavy mist has caused 5 units to trip at Creel Power Station, which has caused there to be a higher risk of load shedding. I'm fairly shocked by this. I don't know what's next. Maybe someone's going to, you know, it's going to rain on the coal and the coal will be wet. I mean, can you imagine that happening? That'd be crazy. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We hope you all have a wonderful day and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Print Show. Cheers, everyone.